giant of limitless power at man's command. And where was it science found that giant? In the atom, a particle so infinitely small that it takes over 100 billion atoms to make up the head of a pin.
This is Out of the Basement, a podcast dedicated to radiation medicine.
This is Dr. Jason Becht coming at you from the Vermont Mountain Basements, hunkered down in the Vermont Mountain Basements, presuming that people are upset about my take on supervision. I honestly don't know. I'm actually trying to be organized and record these things ahead of time instead of at 2 a.m. like normal. And I'm always reminded of whenever this topic comes up, in most topics, just like with the Simone's Maxims episode, I'm reminded of Sayer's Law, which is one of my favorite quote-unquote laws, but it's the formulation. In any dispute, the intensity of feeling is inversely proportional to the value of the issues at stake. By way of corollary, it adds, that is why academic politics are so bitter. Man, does that ring true. Academic politics is the most vicious and bitter form of politics because the stakes are so low. But in this case, and that's the point of this episode, the stakes aren't necessarily that low. The intent of this multi-episode series here, because supervision is very complicated. Again, that's why I didn't like law. This isn't stone tablet stuff. This is all invented by humans. So we're making it all up and then it changes. But to recap, so we're talking about supervision as CMS defines it, as the government defines it, as it pertains to billing Medicare, Medicaid, as it pertains to radiation therapy. So for those who are already in this field, I don't need to clarify why that's a thing we fight about. But if you're maybe considering this field or new to this field, you don't understand why this has all been so bitter, why we care so much about this. But to recap, in the late 90s, and maybe even before that, but Lord knows, I can only be so nerdy about this, so I'm not going to go back even further. And I'm sure I could find some argument in some journals somewhere. But in the late 90s, CMS decided to create regulation around supervision of therapeutic and diagnostic procedures. The supervision levels were personal, direct, and general. And so in the beginning, the belief, or at least the belief came from the way it was written, but the belief was that this allegedly applied only to non-hospital environments. We call it freestanding, but these supervision regulation requirements do not apply to hospitals. But then around 2009, 2010, with the Cures Act, the passage of the Cures Act, it decided to clarify these rules and say that they apply to hospitals too. And more awesome, it also clarified that these rules were backwards applicable, meaning that theoretically, and this was the concerns that were expressed by groups like the American Hospital Association and others, that this would open up a slew of whistleblower cases, because if you're doing something one way for 10 years, and then all of a sudden the government says, oh, by the way, here's actually what we meant, and we meant it for before too, and you didn't know, oh, that's probably a problem. And then also the critical access hospitals and rural providers asked for an exception, which was granted, meaning they asked for non-enforcement of this. What if you just say it like that, what a crazy thing to do from the government where they had never said this before. So that's a mess. And that means it's whistleblower case time. And which is why joking about the viciousness of academic politics doesn't necessarily apply here, but we'll get there. A whistleblower case is the technical term, is a QTAM case. And it took me years to figure out how to say that correctly until I talked to lawyers myself. It's the QUITAM, QTAM case. And so 2009-ish, it was really when a lot of things changed. So not only did you have the Cures Act and the clarification of this, it was a monster year for whistleblower cases in general. So early in the year, you have introductions of things like H.R. 27, the Medicare Fraud Prevention and Enforcement Act, where basically if you submit a claim or cause a claim to be submitted that or should know is false or fraudulent, you can get kicked out of participating in Medicare, which, you know, is a big deal if you're a doctor. You also have things like the Physician Payment Sunshine Act of 2009, which is the instigator of openpayments.gov, where you can go and see if a physician who participates in Medicare has ever received any form of payment from any sort of industry partner, like pharma or anything like that. And then just in general, when I say monster year for the False Claims Act, FCA enforcement, the DOJ said that it had 2.4 billion in civil settlements and judgments and FCA cases for the fiscal year ending in September 30th, 2009. So that was the second largest annual recovery of civil fraud claims, and only the third time recoveries have exceeded $2 billion in a single year. And that just year alone raised the total FCA recovery since 1986 to more than $24 billion. If in all that time, $24 billion was the total, it was $2.4 billion in that one year. And the nearly $2 billion of that, so most of that was from the QTAM provision, so the whistleblower. Part of that, and we'll get into this in a minute here, is that the relators, so the actual whistleblowers themselves, get percentage of that. So that's how the government incentivizes people to whistleblow. You're not going to just, most people probably aren't going to snitch on stuff if there's no reason for them to snitch. But if you pay them a lot of money, they will definitely do that. And so the government got $2.4 billion. The people who did the whistleblowing collected $255 million just in 2009. And then the whistleblower protections were strengthened that year as well. Because really, this is like the main way the government regulates stuff. Just like I was talking about in the prior episode, there is no sort of all-seeing eye that is checking everything for truth and correctness and legality and whatnot. The government is mostly relying on the citizens. Because if you think about it, that makes total sense, where we're all wrapped up in our own little worlds, and America's a big place. And the volume and size and nature of transactions, because this is, again, not just medicine. This is everything. There's a lot of entities that either receive payments from the government or make payments to the government. It would be impossible to track all that. So they're really relying on people to do the legwork for them. And it only makes sense that the government would incentivize that. So that's what's happening. And again, very unfortunate for us, for radiation medicine, just in general, because if all these things were happening around the same time of just the troubles. And so let's just pause there, and we're going to go into defining what all these things really mean, because I just feel like we jump right into this and I say things like FCA and QTAM and relator, and what the heck are those things? They don't teach you this in med school, at least not when I was there. And so I'm going to pull out of this from a paper that was from Applied Radiation Oncology, published in 2015. And it was written by a gentleman named Anthony Mastriani, who has a JD, MBA, and MD, and at the time of this publication was a former accountant and prosecutor, but then was working as a radiation oncologist at the Cleveland Clinic. And his co-author was John McCaffrey, who is a former FBI special agent and prosecutor, was a partner with Tucker Ellis in Cleveland, Ohio, where his practice focuses on white-collar criminal defense and business litigation. And that gentleman in particular served as both relator's counsel and defended individuals and organizations involved in False Claims Acts proceedings. Here is the intro.
Target tumors, not yourself. A review of False Claims Act allegations against radiation oncologists. The Department of Justice is investigating radiation oncology service providers. Why? In the words of the infamous American bank robber Willie Sutton, because that's where the money is. Last year in 2014, CMS disclosed the amounts paid to physicians, and radiation oncologists were among the top recipients of federal monies. Each year, CMS pays hundreds of millions in radiation oncology claims, which steadily rise with the growing use of complex and costly radiation treatments, secondary to rapidly evolving technologies. As a result, the Department of Justice and plaintiff attorneys have pursued lawsuits against radiation oncology providers with claims of fraud, abuse, and waste.
Target tumors, not yourself, is a pretty clever title. I admit that I really like it. And it does an excellent job of describing what the False Claims Act is.
The False Claims Act, originally known as the Informers Act or the Lincoln Law, was enacted in 1863 at the height of the Civil War, primarily to combat fraud allegations in the United States procurement of Union Army supplies. The damages and penalties available under the False Claims Act are significant, and the misconduct actionable under the False Claims Act is broad and sweeping. The False Claims Act is a federal statute that reaches not only the submission of a false claim, but also the making of a record or statement to obtain payment or approval of a false claim, the possession of property or money used to defraud the government, illegal purchases from a government officer or employee, and the making of a false record to conceal, avoid, or decrease a financial obligation to the government. The popularity of the False Claims Act as an anti-fraud weapon is due, in part, to the government's ability to obtain sizable recoveries through treble damages and penalties of up to $11,000 per claim.
And here is my favourite part.
The most common act prohibited by the False Claims Act is where a person presents, or causes another to present, a false or fraudulent claim for payment, and the person involved knows the claim is false or fraudulent. Knowingly means, one, having knowledge, two, acting in deliberate ignorance of the truth or falsity of the information, or three, acting in reckless disregard of the truth or falsity of the information. No proof of specific intent to defraud is required.
So I'll paraphrase further from the paper, and basically deliberate ignorance requires proving that a provider would have had a reason to believe their actions or its actions may have been unlawful, and that the provider purposefully or purposely failed to investigate any suspicions. In determining whether there was a quote-unquote reckless disregard, courts have considered clumsiness, carelessness, and foolishness in the extreme, lack of slight diligence or care, and omission in reckless disregard of a legal duty. Part of why I like doing this, I love reading legal stuff. They get very spicy sometimes. But under the QTAM provision of the False Claims Act, a private person may bring a civil action on behalf of the United States. So the plaintiff or the relator must provide the Department of Justice with a copy of the complaint and a written disclosure of all material evidence and information known to the relator. The complaint then remains under seal for at least 60 days, during which time the DOJ attorneys decide whether they want to proceed with or decline taking over the action, leaving the relator with the right to conduct the action once the complaint is unsealed. The relator is entitled to a portion of the damages recovered in the action, regardless of whether the government proceeds with it. The relator's recovery can range from 10% to 25% of the proceeds, which can also include attorney's fees. And in the whistleblower protection provision, the False Claims Act creates a federal cause of action for any employee retaliated against by an employer for aiding in the FCA prosecution. Importantly, the cause of action is not limited to just QTAM relators. As a result of an amendment to the original law, it covers any employee, contractor, agent, or associated others. The amendment allows an action for retaliation to be based on relationship outside the traditional employer-employee relationship. And any protected individual who investigates, initiates, testifies, or assists in an FCA action can bring a cause of action being protected. And I think that's the key part here that people don't know about. And if you don't just magically, so if you go and say, I'm going to whistleblow on this, and you have to go to a law firm, usually, like you can, I guess you could theoretically just bring it to the government yourself, but usually if you feel like you have a case, you bring it to a law firm, and then the law firm will work with you to put it together, and then they will bring it to the government on your behalf, and then the government then decides whether or not they want to pursue it with you. So it's not automatic where the government's not going to be like, thank you for this case. We're going to run with it. There's a lot of steps leading up to that. And then the government can say, no, we're not going to do this, which has been what has happened with the supervision stuff. We'll get to that in a minute. But you are still able to pursue the case. Even if the government says, no, we aren't going to help you with this, they're also generally not going to stop you from doing it. Now, what that means is you have to self-fund it, like you and the law firm. And then, so you'd essentially be fighting for government money on behalf of the government without them helping you. The upshot of that being that you would get a portion of those proceeds. And that's why I'm not aware, and I'm sure it's happened, but I'm not really aware of this happening in medicine, because if the money is big enough that a individual is going to self-fund a QTAM case, like the government is generally not going to decline it. If a case is that strong and has that much potential in terms of reward, the government's going to take it. So it's theoretically possible. It's generally not something that you see, but here's more from the paper.
Once the government receives a complaint along with material evidence and information, it has several options. First, it can request an extension of the 60-day sealing period. Second, it can elect to intervene and take over the action. Third, it can notify the court that it declines to intervene, permitting the relator to conduct the action in place of the government. Fourth, it can move to dismiss or stay the relator's proceeding with the matter on the grounds that action would interfere with an ongoing criminal investigation. Finally, the government can attempt to settle the action before declaring its formal intervention decision. Even if the government initially declines to intervene, it can do so later upon showing good cause.
If the government elects to intervene in an FCA QTAM proceeding, the government files its complaint in intervention, which then generally includes the allegations identified in the original complaint. The government's complaint may add or delete certain allegations and parties, plead specific common law claims such as common law fraud, breach of contract, and unjust enrichment, which a relator cannot bring in a QTAM proceeding for lack of standing and enforceable legal right to such claims. It's very interesting. There's a lot of twists and turns, and then it's just going to change again. The consternation around supervision really stems from that onslaught, or at least the perception of an onslaught of these whistleblower cases brought against our colleagues, usually by our colleagues, but at least brought against our colleagues. And the 2015 paper here, it discusses this at least up to that point in time. The claim for medically unnecessary services, those that are not properly supervised or lacking proper documentation supporting the service, is typically the basis for what happened in those first 6 years after that change. And at least as it pertains to FCA actions brought against RADONC, and Medicare reimburses and participating providers agree to submit claims only for services medically necessary to diagnose, treat an injury or illness, and for which the provider maintains adequate documentation justifying treatment. So services performed without appropriate supervision are not considered reasonable and necessary, and therefore are not covered under Medicare. Failure to provide required supervisory care renders the service non-reimbursable because the services are deemed medically unnecessary. The three levels of supervision, general, direct, and personal, the paper implores us to, should be well known to all radiation oncology providers as they relate to services.
A False Claims Act requires specific allegations concerning the allegedly fraudulent behavior of the defendants. Recently filed actions against radiation oncology providers all contain a common allegation: lack of or improper supervision of procedures requiring either direct supervision, as in daily treatments, simulations, and IMRT, or personal supervision, as in SBRT, SRS, or brachytherapy. In addition to submitting claims for services provided when the physician was not present, some actions demonstrate the incredulous lengths to which providers have taken to circumvent supervision requirements. Other false claim actions allegations include overuse of CPT codes, illegal kickbacks, improper referrals, failure to provide appropriate services, improper treatment, and lack of operable equipment.
I would note in this era that while the opinion around direct supervision would be a reasonable one, this paper is interesting that it writes specifically there's this personal supervision requirement around SBRT and SRS. Even in that time, that's a questionable sort of thing. But the point being, just to reinforce from the prior episode as well, that the way I feel like we talk about this in terms of supervision is more of a legal one, like you're not doing the right thing, or it's bad in a moral sense. And the reason it is regulated, this is, it's trying to prevent fraud and abuse in a way. And so if you zoom out from our little bubble here and what we think we care about and the rest of the world, the government is trying to prevent people from just billing things that they didn't do or didn't have happen. And there's a safety component, of course, or at least in an ideal world, there's a safety component, but this is the way that they twist the knife of saying we shouldn't have paid you for this, where if you're not doing the thing in the way that the government thinks that you should be doing the thing and in the way that they paid you for doing the thing, then it is medically unnecessary, you committed fraud, and so on and so forth. So that's just to really divorce again. This isn't a comment from the government on medicine itself. And obviously, again, it is, but it's not saying like what you did was right or wrong in terms of a objective medical standpoint, but in terms of a thing we paid you for and you told us you did not do it. The paper, rather than try to chop this up, because the paper, I don't know if my little AI narrators could handle this one. If you guys go and look at these cases, they always have bizarre Byzantine names so case numbering, filing, they're obscure. So I'm just going to run through vocally myself rather than break the internet trying to make the AI do this, the cases that they have here. So the first one they start with is the Vantage Oncology case in the United States District Court of Ohio. And that one, now I'm also going to skip over some of the things. So a lot of these cases have more to them. And that's the thing is that most of these cases that have the supervision component also have other stuff. And we'll be here forever if I read through all of that. But really, 2015, Target Tumors, Not Yourself, it's a good paper to go read. But so in this Vantage Oncology case, the failure to render required supervisory care, claims for treatment were submitted during periods when the physician was on vacation and or was at centers other than those where patients were treated and billed. And so right here, this is probably why this case was successful on behalf of the government. In one instance, a patient undergoing treatment died with no physician available to aid in resuscitation efforts. To create the illusion of physician presence during treatment, GoToMyPC software was used despite a compliance officer's recognition that virtual review did not satisfy image-guided radiation therapy or IMRT requirements. Prior to 2009, this time period for a majority of the claims in this particular complaint, IGRT required personal supervision, and subsequent to January 1st, 2009, IGRT required direct physician supervision. IMRT required and continues to require direct supervision. So again, this is how confusing this is, and we'll get to the whole teasing out and separating IGRT from the actual delivery is interesting. But right there, so that should tell you about it. There's always something else, and because if this depends, this is a human enterprise, so you got to think about what it takes. So imagine you are at a clinic and it's just like you and maybe one other doc. We're a small specialty. And if you are the relator, if you are the whistleblower, that's a lot. You are going to be looked at a certain way. And anyone in these cases, either whether you're the whistleblower or the person being whistleblown against, that is going to stick with you forever. So in general, people don't want to expose themselves to this or put themselves through this. So you're not going to get generally, or at least we're not going to hear about frivolous QTM cases. And so in this one, you had a patient died. And now, important to note, it does not say here, and I haven't gone and read this case in detail, but it does not say here died from the radiation, of course, but the patient died and there was no physician around to aid in resuscitation efforts. Now, that could mean a bazillion things, but right there, that's notable. And then the other one was intentionally creating this image of supervision with GoToMyPC. Interestingly, again, this would be allowed now, assuming that there's an audiovisual component of this is direct virtual. This is now allowed. But that's how you would see these things. This is pretty fantastic in a notoriety sense, and why it's more than just the supervision stuff. That's the Vantage Oncology. Then the next one is a Baylor University at Dallas case, and that one was a QTM action brought about by a radiation oncologist and a radiation therapist alleging violation of physician supervision requirements at Baylor's Radiosurgery Center, as well as violation of the Anti-Kickback Statute and STARC Act. This is interesting. Documentation supported Baylor and Texas Oncology's knowledge of supervision requirements for radiosurgery procedures, but Baylor relaxed existing supervision rules to allow the Texas Oncology physicians to see patients at another location at the same time with the ongoing radiosurgery procedures. And this was clearly seen in the provided patient schedules. But how they did this was very interesting. The case was made on overlooking supervision rules was alleged to be an inducement to refer SRS and chemotherapy patients to Baylor, constituting illegal kickbacks under the AKS and violating the STARC Act. Also alleged as an inducement was the naming of a Texas Oncology radiation oncologist as an associate director of Baylor's SRS Center, even though he would not have any management or supervisory role, a position allegedly created as a means of inducing referrals for financial grants. So that's, I like this one as an illustration of how messed up this all is, because nobody was hurt there. So the case was not made on a patient dying. The case was not made on making a mysterious sort of computer system to give the illusion of what we now know as virtual direct supervision, but it was twisting the supervisory regulations to invoke anti-kickback and STARC. Very interesting in terms of the implications behind that. And this kind of really speaks when I talk to people who, the United States is a large country. It's, again, stupid to say, but especially if you're a resident or if you're somebody who did residency in that one place and then only stayed in that institution for your career, you're not going to see the wild stuff that's out there. And it's really like a state by state. It's so regional. All of this stuff is so insanely regional. And this clearly has a flavor. So if you go back to the 21C episode and the 21C and the Florida cancer specialist and what happened there, there's, and then because it's very regional, the behavior, the emotions, the opinions. Further, who your, so what law firm, if you were to try to do this, it would depend on the law firm you bring the case to, your relationship with the law firm, then who the law firm brings to in the government, because a case might be, the United States might elect to intervene in a case if you are in South Dakota, but the exact same situation in a California court, they might not. And so then exactly like what you see here, why the case is successful, and successful is a weird, successful from my point of view, from the point of view of the United States, there's a lot of things going on. So we always talk about supervision, and or at least I do, in terms of a safety sort of aspect. And this is really just about politics with AKS and Stark. But so I like that one as an illustration for kind of other ways that this is invoked here. But so the next one is the Gulf Region Radiation Ecology Centers. And this was in Florida, our favorite Florida. So this was a $3.5 million settlement and supervision claims. So for nearly 4 years, two radiation oncologists provided services for three locations. One on vacation, only one physician was available for all three. All of the three centers, one contracted with this practice to provide radiation services. When issues of coverage and billing were brought to the attention of that hospital, neither the hospital or the practice were willing to pay for additional coverage or change billing practices. So not only were supervision claims brought for simulations, treatments, and other procedures, but similar to other QTAM actions, the usual litany of claims related to lack of medical necessity documentations and or routine claims on all patients for special physics consults, treatment procedures, devices, and so on. And then here's another kicker, similar to the first one. Allegations that no physician was present when a patient required transport to the emergency room strengthen the relator's allegations against the practice. You know, it's always something else. The next one is an Adventist health system in also Florida. This was inappropriate supervision as well as lack of supervision claims, which resulted in a settlement of $5.4 million. The relator was a radiation oncologist who brought the suit against his employer, the Florida Oncology Network, and the hospital system for which that network provided radiation oncology professional services. And the complaint was that the network lacked sufficient radoncs to be present for each of its multiple facilities, instead relying on nearby emergency room physicians, unaffiliated medoncs, and nurse practitioners and physician assistants. Anywhere from 10 to 15 patients per day, up to 80 to 100 patients per day, were treated at sites covered by this network. None of the sites were scheduled to have full-time coverage by radoncs, except the location with the fewest patients on treatment. This is the only site where they collected all their technical and professional revenue. Two sites were scheduled to be covered by only one radonc simultaneously, and other physicians were scheduled to perform brachytherapy, intraoperative therapy services, external beams, patients were undergoing treatment. So as in the other actions, a patient sustained an injury at a site without a nurse or radiation oncologist present, at which time the presumed supervising unaffiliated medonc refused to offer medical attention. A more serious allegation concerned the simulation of a spine where evidence of prior radiation could have been noted had a radiation oncologist been present, resulting in a patient's paraplegia secondary to radiation necrosis of the spinal cord due to re-irradiation. Similar to other actions presented here, the complaint reiterated investigations of radiation mishaps as reported in numerous newspaper articles. The final case discussed in this particular paper is the Winter Park Urology case from, let's hear it one more time, Florida. Always Florida. And this was interesting because it was not about supervision or lack thereof. It was about who is doing the supervising, and also that the radiation oncologists who were named in this trial had the case against them dismissed on the eve of the trial. And basically, so there's two interesting parts. One, the relator was actually the director of medical physics who first went to management worried about the routine billing for a special physics consult without that being done at the request of a physician, and he was fired 4 days later. Generally bad idea to do that. Don't, if you run a business, especially one where you're in a space like healthcare, generally don't want to fire somebody when they have a safety complaint. Just throwing that out there. But so what differentiates this case from the other ones is that the allegation was that the physician supervising was inappropriate, meaning that while a urologist was present when patients were undergoing daily radiation, the radiation oncologists were not routinely on site. And the estimate is that 35% of all radiation procedures were performed when there was no radonc around. And then further, the relator alleged that the radonc was never present for IGRT. Again, the weird part being back in the old days, allegedly, again, according to this paper, IGRT required personal supervision prior to 2009, and Direct started in January of 2009. Instead, the radiation oncologist would review the images weekly. And it's hard. I want to throw a lot of shade on this, but it's important to remember, even for me, that IGRT was more new, kind of, for those of us who came into this specialty in the clinical side after 2010. IMRT, then the routine use of IMRT, and then IGRT and onboard imaging, and then the routine use of IGRT, and then VMAT. That all happened from like 2002 to 2009, 2010, so it was pretty quick. So when IGRT first came out, I could see it. I'm like, all right, I get it. But anyway, so the paper then goes on to discuss the confusing definitions, or lack thereof, for the various supervision levels.
While the definition of personal supervision is clear, attendance in the room during the procedure, Medicare has declined to define immediate for purposes of direct supervision in terms of time or distance. Defining immediate is beyond the scope of this article, and the reader is directed to appropriate legal commentary. Reports of radiation mishaps that occur secondary to a physician's lack of supervision are reported in the general media. The tragic results reported in the referenced article were reiterated in the body of one of the whistleblower actions discussed here, emphasizing that the lack of a physician's presence during treatment is an effectively damaging and easily proven allegation.
The paper continues on at length, but it does bring up an important point, which is that the easiest case to win is one that is obviously shocking to a jury and or a judge, such as where a patient is injured or dies, and a narrative can pretty easily be constructed to imply blame on the doctor, such as can be done when you have these very nebulous supervision levels and definitions and whatnot. But here's a concluding paragraph from this paper.
As supervision-related claims were the simplest claims to support in the above cases, supervision requirements must be adhered to and are reasonably clear. The Office of the Inspector General and Department of Justice consider supervision important and critical to patient safety. Less clear is who may supervise, which is an evolving issue that may be resolved by hospitals in complying with CMS rules for conditions of participation with respect to privileging. While certain medical practices have expanded definitions of who can be privileged to perform certain procedures, cost containment strategies that would allow anyone other than a physician trained in radiation oncology to supervise radiation treatments should be reviewed with legal counsel. CMS language requiring the training and knowledge to clinically redirect the service or provide additional orders provides prudent guidance when establishing policies.
I love that. Oh boy, I love that. They literally can't even string more than three sentences together without contradicting themselves. So to reiterate, as supervision-related claims were the simplest claims to support in the above cases, supervision requirements must be adhered to and are reasonably clear. The Office of the Inspector General and Department of Justice considers supervision important and critical to patient safety. Less clear is who may supervise, which is an evolving issue that may be resolved by hospitals in complying with CMS rules for conditions of participation with respect to privileging. I am not quite sure how the authors can state that supervision requirements are both reasonably clear yet less clear when it pertains to who may supervise. I'm not a lawyer, but that sounds like it's not clear to me. And the one thing that is abundantly clear and made clear over and over is the more obvious something can be made to sound horrific to a layperson, the better chance you have of winning a case. To a random person with zero medical experience, it is very easy to paint a picture that radiation treatment being delivered without a radiation oncologist nearby is analogous to surgery being performed without a surgeon nearby, which is, of course, completely ridiculous. However, the average person doesn't know that. Worse, the very way doctors are trained to think about data and evidence means we are extremely bad at defending ourselves, which we will get to in a moment. And did you guys really think I was going to do this episode without talking about Todd? Come on. So weirdly, this paper, and I'm not quite sure why, did not talk about my good friend Todd Scarborough and the case that started it all. So it is not me intentionally delaying talking about this. Rather, the paper itself doesn't even bring this up, which I understand. But this is all really tied together in a very weird way that I didn't quite see until I started drafting this episode out a long time ago, obviously. And it is crazy to see how all these things collided. The stars aligned for this particular case to happen and really to set things off. And it is actually very relevant to today. And that certain legacy professional societies are realizing that maybe we need to have some better PR. And while they haven't set this out yet, maybe they are to blame for some of this themselves. So to really have a unifying theory of everything and reflect on where we are, when you had X-rays and radium discovered in 1895 and 1896, not respectively, reverse that, but there was an era of essentially radiomania, which we all are aware of. That's where radium girls came from, that the radium watch dial painters, all the quack, what used to be called patent medicines. There is about a 30-year period where radiation, specifically radium mostly, but radiation was put in everything and it was said to be a cure-all. And then just people forget that with the radium girl story, it's not like they were ignorant. Having the watch dial painters lick the paintbrushes, that was a known safety hazard. That was gross negligence by the managers of that factory. They should burn in hell. They knew that was bad. Okay. It wasn't like radiation was some mystery. They knew that they shouldn't do that. But you had this overexuberance, and this is the cycle of discovery, the cycle of innovation. You're seeing it right now with artificial intelligence, AI. You have this initial period of extreme excitement after the discovery or release or whatever. And then people start to become disillusioned and call it like a bubble. And you saw this with the dot-com bubble and those things. And so then there's a valley of despair. And as long as people stick with it, which they always do, eventually the technology catches up to the hype to a degree. Just this is how it is. This is always how it is. And so we saw this with radiation. And so you had this 30-year period in the beginning. Now, the difference with radiation is then we had the atomic bombs. And so you had atomic weapons in World War II, which were horrific. And then you had Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, which Three Mile Island effectively killed nuclear power in America, and the Cold War. And so you had this period of just radiophobia, which we are arguably still in today. Coupled with that, and this is for a future episode, the absolute lies that is the linear no threshold model, which if you guys, I'm going to have to dig into this, but if you look that up, just Google that. Google linear no threshold bad, or I don't know. But when that's where ALARA, or as low as reasonably allowable, came from, and why hormesis is a dirty word, and so on and so forth. Anyway, all this stuff for another time. It's not like radiation is the most beloved thing. And so you had, just to recap, because we've touched on a lot of it here in this episode and the prior episode, and you had these supervision levels created in the 90s, and then you had this flurry of activity in from basically 2008 to 2010, where you had the Cures Act, and the government said, oh, by the way, these supervisory levels also exist for hospital outpatients and inpatients and can be backdated or back apply, however, I don't even know how you say that. And then you also had, with the Obama administration coming in, a focus on healthcare in general. That's when the ACA was passed and all these things. And part of that, as we touched on at the top of this episode, was a focus on the whistleblower stuff, the False Claims Act, and just really aggressive enforcement on that. And that was seen as a way to mitigate healthcare spending. Yeah. And most importantly, arguably, in my opinion, is the Radiation Boom series by Walt Bogdanich. And that was published in the New York Times from 2008 to 2010, and he was actually a Pulitzer finalist in 2011 for this, and we'll talk about that in a second. But so in the setting of this, in the backdrop of this, you have Todd's case, the MEMA case, and if you could go and Google this, there is a March 26, 2010 blog post from the law firm that represented the relator in this case, and it writes, the major new healthcare law that the president signed this week, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, Public Law 111-148, includes increased efforts to combat health care fraud and abuse, especially fraud in the Medicare and Medicaid programs. It It was significant that on the very same day this law took effect, an outstanding group of government prosecutors and investigators brought to an efficient conclusion a $12 million recovery of funds in a QTAM whistleblower case alleging healthcare fraud in violation of the False Claims Act. The case was brought by our firm, Finch McCrane, LLP, the Simpson Firm, LLC, and James G. Castino, PA.
After investigating the whistleblower's claims, the U.S. Department of Justice joined the lawsuit and filed its own complaint alleging a sustained fraudulent course of conduct by the Mima Cancer Center and its former medical director, Todd Scarborough, MD. The government's complaint contended that Mima submitted millions of dollars of claims for radiation oncology services that were provided without required physician supervision, were never provided at all or were otherwise improper, and sought to hide the fraud through sham practices. The complaint also alleged that executives at Mima were aware of a substantial number of the fraudulent billing practices.
This is just very interesting to view through the lens of history, and it's, to me, to try to understand this, it is most helpful to put yourself in this era, in this situation, because it seems nonsense now, but when this case came out, you have to remember that and if you go read like some of the Astro newsletters and things, they talk about this, everyone was blindsided with the New York Times articles where that was out of nowhere, at least it felt. And it was predated by a Philadelphia Inquirer story about a VA issue and brachytherapy. But so that really took everyone by surprise. And that these articles are brutal. They're just brutal. And so they're really fresh. Those wounds are there. And that was 2008. So then this stuff happens. You have the election, and then you have Obama come in, and then you have the passage of these particular pieces of legislation that really focus on healthcare and on the False Claims Act and all these things. And then you have this case, you have Todd's case. If you go and you can read this in the New York Times, it's published by our buddy Walt. So Walt and co-author Rebecca R. Ruiz in the New York Times on February 25th, 2010, it's radiation bills raise question of supervision. And it details what the case was about. I'll quote or read through some of this. IGRT, one of the most advanced applications in radiotherapy, incorporates the use of imaging equipment to guide the radiation. Because it is a complex and relatively new technology, federal rules required that the radiation oncologist be present to make real-time correction to the imaging device prior to treatments. This is online. So we don't do this anymore. We do this for SBRT and SRS, but obviously this is not how things are done now. But from 2006 through 2007, the Cancer Center reviewed the images only after treatment or not at all, prosecutor said, to create the illusion that doctors were providing contemporaneous supervision. Dr. Scarborough used handheld devices through which images were supposedly received and reviewed in real time. Yet records from AT&T, which serviced the handheld devices, showed that the data transfer was so minimal there could never have been the daily receipt and review of the hundreds of images that were indicated as billed, the government said. As a sidebar to quote Todd, they only looked at cellular data and not Wi-Fi data. But this really, everything about this story is dated because the handheld devices, those are cell phones. So the iPhone came out shortly before this. So as I recall, I think the iPhone was released in 2007, but in our world, this is not a handheld device. Like, it's a cell phone, man. It's a smartphone, but they did not have this then. So in this era, cell phones were not real, or smartphones were not real. And IGRT, your run-of-the-mill IGRT required online image review. So obviously this doesn't exist now, but here's my favorite part of this whole article. Dr. Simon N. Powell, chairman of radiation oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, said his hospital did not use handheld devices to review images. We would want to monitor treatment very closely, Dr. Powell said. Approving images remotely is something that we would not condone. Dr. Powell said IGRT is billed at a higher rate for a reason. More work is certainly involved. Some Medicare rules have been relaxed and no longer require the physician to actually observe the treatment. It does require that before the machine is turned on, the physician has reviewed the last set of images, said Dr. David C. Beyer, who serves on the board of directors of the American Society of Therapeutic Radiation and Oncology. And it's a very interesting passage to read. Sitting here in 2023 when I'm recording this, having trained long after IGRT and VMAT were routine or considered routine And obviously, I'm not going to try to defend Todd because he's my friend. I am. I guess I can't help it in a sense. But we judge others by their actions and ourselves by our intentions. The disclaimer is that even though I've talked to him at length about this, a lot of these things, before I ever met him and knew any of this, I had arrived at similar conclusions. But so you take a look at this particular article and compare that to the cases that were discussed in the 2015 papers. This particular whistleblower case was about a time of 2006 to 2007 when IGRT was new. And in that brief window, personal supervision was thought to be required for IGRT, and then it was rapidly changed. And I know I harp on this a lot, but I think it really just matters for context about how quickly radiation medicine changed. And if there's one mission for me to accomplish in life, it's to just drive this point home. And these things are squishy. They don't have hard dates, but you figure about 2002, that's when you really just see IMRT take off like a rocket ship. And then IGRT, as we know it, was technically a little bit after, meaning that this actually confused me. This took me a while to figure out where I didn't care or didn't understand why people cared about OBI or onboard imaging. Because to me, of course you have it. Like, why wouldn't you? But if you look back into this era, it is sold as a bonus. It is marketed as an advancement. And that's just really bizarre to think about. But so you have IMRT, then you have the technologically advanced onboard imaging. And Lord knows the one part I can't put myself in is why this was felt to require personal supervision. Like, maybe that's a thing for another time. I'll have to look into that. That part confuses me a bit. But it seems based on this article, based on conversations with Todd, based on articles and things, that really from 2006 to 2009 was the only time that IGRT was felt to have personal supervision requirements. And then the government rather quickly switched over to direct, which is very interesting. Like, how did that happen? Because the government doesn't move that fast. But so putting this all together, this case is notable for the window when it was essentially about personal supervision for IGRT. It was before the smartphone, or it was concurrent with the smartphone. So low language handheld devices. What this is describing is what we call virtual direct supervision now. And seriously, that's what, and I always joke about this with Todd, was that he was just doing 2023 techniques with 2006 technology. Now, again, just because a regulation or law is silly, you should not try to intentionally flout that law. And that's bad. But that's what sets this apart from the other ones. There is no sensational patient injury or death. There is no political inducement, anti-kickback flavor. There is no wildly unsafe sprawling scheme about too many sites and not enough doctors. It was the brief window in time when personal supervision was required for IGRT. It was the brief window of time where the smartphone had yet to be invented or widespread adoption. It was the brief window in time when radiation was under assault by the New York Times more aggressively than now. It was this brief moment in time when there was rumblings about how much more we were costing than how much we used to cost. And then it was also this brief moment in time when the government decided to really focus on False Claims Act and whistleblower healthcare fraud stuff. It was the perfect storm. And the one thing that I would point out is I would encourage everyone to go read the Todd case, the Mima case, read the 2015 paper that summarizes the other cases that followed. And then in the next episode, we'll cover some other stuff. But, and then to me, you compare this to the 21C FCS case from the prior episodes. And we have a person who was granted immunity in a criminal antitrust trial, the first one in 30 years, testified, and not only held leadership positions in that company, but also in our primary legacy professional society, primary author of a proposed piece of legislation for revamping how we're paid entirely. And if I hadn't done that episode, that podcast episode, how many people knew that individual was granted immunity in a criminal trial, in a criminal antitrust trial directly related to his work as a physician, compared to how many people knew about Todd's case? And the even now, the reactions to Todd versus the reaction to Constantine Mantz are very different. And you got to ask yourself why. Life isn't fair, of course, but I feel to me that of those two stories, one is clearly worse, however you want to define that. And I think that really perfectly illustrates the point of the power of the media and what we should have been doing. And that's part of the intent of this podcast, of Cold Light, of all those things, because I think in terms of what happened to radiation oncology in America, radiation medicine, Walt Bogdanich, I can never get that man's name, but I think that's, let's call him Walt, New York Times and the Radiation Boom series, which was published from 2008 to 2010, was probably one of the most harmful things that has ever happened in radiation medicine. And I know, again, going back to judging someone by their intentions versus actions, I know he meant, I believe his heart was in the right place. But I think that the consequences of him choosing to do that was incredibly harmful to the American population. He was a finalist for a Pulitzer. I don't know if you guys knew this, but Walt was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Investigative Journalism in 2011. The description, if you go to the Pulitzer website, is as to why he was nominated, was for his spotlighting of medical radiation errors that injured thousands of Americans, sparking national discussion and remedial steps. And there's a 2020 blog post over at the ASCO blog that's written by some of our legacy leadership that summarizes it quite well.
In 2009, an investigation involving prostate cancer brachytherapy made it to the front pages of the Philadelphia Inquirer and was even featured in a hotly contested Democratic Senate primary. But that little foretaste of trouble to come seemed to blow over fast. However, in January 2010, the blue skies turned black when an investigative reporter from the New York Times, Walt Bogdanich, released the first in a rapid-fire series of articles on radiation safety. During this period of exuberant expansion, radiation technology had been installed at institutions that did not have the training, experience, or capacity to handle it safely. There was no communication between institutions across the nation. Many of the cases were lawyered up so that others could not learn from them, and the checklist-based, non-hierarchical culture that characterized the airline industry was not yet prevalent in medicine. It took the power of a free investigative press to show us what, in retrospect, was evidently present.
So in talking about Walt, I've actually had to go back and re-record this a couple times to tone it down a bit because I have such a strong reaction to him. But if you guys haven't read this series of articles, it's worth doing. And it's worth reflecting on the impact of that on society. And the reason being, it's worth doing it for a few reasons. One, just to have context. So putting yourself, I know I like to go after certain legacy societies and individuals and things, but we were ill-equipped to handle what happened. Now, you could argue perhaps we should have sought outside help and whatnot. Doesn't matter. It happened. It's a thing. Here we are. And the way that journalism works is very different than how medicine works, which seems to be a ridiculously obvious statement, but it's a fundamental difference that renders journalism very effective in the eyes of the general population and medicine very ineffective. And it's all in how Walt tells his stories to make his point, and then how we respond to Walt and those stories to make our point, and that we think we are defending ourselves when we might be if we were talking to each other, but we're not when we're talking to Walt and the general people. To illustrate this point, I'm going to first, let's play the intro to one of Walt's articles in this time period. It's the one titled, Radiation Offers New Cures and Ways to Do Harm.
As Scott Jerome Parks lay dying, he clung to this wish that his fatal radiation overdose, which left him deaf, struggling to see, unable to swallow, burned, with his teeth falling out, with ulcers in his mouth and throat, nauseated, in severe pain and finally, unable to breathe, be studied and talked about publicly so that others might not have to live his nightmare. Sensing death was near, Mr. Jerome Park summoned his family for a final Christmas. His friends sent 2 buckets of sand from the beach where they had played as children so he could touch it, feel it, and remember better days. Mr. Jerome Parks died several weeks later in 2007. He was 43. A New York City hospital treating him for tongue cancer had failed to detect a computer error that directed a linear accelerator to blast his brainstem and neck with errant beams of radiation, not once but on 3 consecutive days.
That's absolutely brutal. That's devastating. That's literally how that article opens in the New York Times and was read by who knows. And the worst part is, if there is only one singular worst part, is that article is still up today. You have to ask yourself, how many people read that article when it was first published now 13 years ago? And how many people have read that article in the 13 years since? What has been the butterfly effect of that article? Just that one, let alone the rest of them. And in case people haven't figured out what I mean by how journalism and medicine communication differ, I'm going to play a clip from, I actually got this off YouTube. So this is the man himself, Walt himself, speaking in May of 2013 at the UCSF Virtual Symposium for Radiation Safety and CT. And this clip was put online 7 years ago, and it only has 51 views. And let's just say that I count for more than one of those. So compare and contrast to, this is exactly what I'm talking about in many ways. So here, listen to this clip, think about the intro to the Radiation Offers New Cures article, reflect on the fact that UCSF was doing an entire symposium on safety, and that this clip from that had 51 views, and I have personally watched it, or I would say 5 to 10 times, I don't know. Here's the first few minutes. So this is a 17-minute long clip. I only am going to play the first couple minutes.
I'd like to start by reading from an email that I received recently from one of the nation's best healthcare reporters, John McKenzie, formerly of ABC News. As I read this, keep in mind that you could not find a more sophisticated consumer of healthcare services than Mr. McKenzie. Here is what he wrote to me. Quote, I went for an annual checkup to a new internist who was also board certified as a cardiologist. He suggested that in addition to learning my cholesterol levels, I should get my cardiac calcium score. He wrote a prescription and sent me off to a popular imaging center on Manhattan's Upper East Side. After filling out the necessary paperwork and a 10-minute wait, I was led into a large room with an imaging table. Everything was fine until I saw the word radiation on one of the signs attached to the wall. I don't know why I hadn't thought about it, but suddenly I recalled your series and the risks involved. The technician told me to lie down on the table. I did, but not before asking, do these machines give off much radiation? No, she reassured, they're very safe. Still uneasy, I asked, do you have other CT machines that give off less radiation? Without hesitating, she looked at me and answered, you want less radiation? I repressed my urge to scream. Yes, I answered softly. The dialogue, as I recall, continued like this. Sure, we can do this on a different machine if you want. And there will be less radiation? Yes. And you will still be able to capture the images you need? Yes. She then led me out of one room into another down the hall. I had a similar table and scanning machine. I am trying my very best to be calm and polite. I want to ask the obvious question, why didn't you offer this to me in the first place? But I am convinced that is only going to drag out my time here. I just want out quickly. The next day I called the cardiologist and told him what happened. He said he was disturbed by this story and would call the imaging center to follow up. But did you specify the radiation level the clinic was to use, I asked. Was it on the script? No, he said. They've assured me that they were using only the lowest radiation levels possible. It should be obvious as to why I use this example to begin my talk on what the public wants and needs to know about medical radiation.
And just when I interject here and ask questions such as, how long ago is this? Why or how was that tech qualified to make a statement such as that? Was it actually true? Was there a trade-off for going to the different machine because you can't get something for nothing? Has there ever been any sort of definitive proof that the differences between whatever machines that were used mattered at all in anything other than potentially reducing the diagnostic accuracy? And it's incredibly important to realize he finds this story so compelling that when he's invited to talk at a safety symposium at UCSF, that this is his opening gambit. He finds this so compelling. And I think that's very important to note, but he continues.
Consumers are largely ignorant about radiation dosages, how they vary, and what risks they pose. Why? Because doctors aren't doing a good job of explaining it. Either because they aren't as knowledgeable as they should be, they don't want to frighten patients, or the worst reason of all, they believe they alone know best. When I started out covering healthcare issues 30 years ago, the subject of quality rarely surfaced. I can give you many examples, but here's one. Back when I worked as a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, my editor, who was a major player in Washington politics, said Tim Russert of Meet the Press wanted me to brief him on then Senator Bob Kerrey's healthcare plan. He was running for presidential nomination back then. For the life of me, I couldn't understand why NBC, with its millions of dollars, needed me to do its research. Sure enough, Tim Russert called me. So how about Kerry's healthcare plan? He asked. I said, well, it's complicated. I was a minute into explaining how it would affect the quality of care to patients when Russert cut me off. How's it going to play on the Hill? He asked. No clue, I said. I thought you wanted to know if the plan was good or bad. 30 seconds later, our conversation ended. He couldn't get off the phone quick enough. If you want to know why our healthcare system is such a mess, spend a little time in Washington. We live in a society where we have freedom to make choices in what consumer goods we buy, in who we send to the State House or Congress, in what medical services we want. Truth is, we know a lot more about consumer goods or our elected officials than we do about the quality of our health care. Now, that's not headline news, of course, and that's beginning to change. But medical radiation remains a black hole for most consumers, and truth be told, for many physicians. I'm sure you are wondering why, with all the things in the world to investigate, I came knocking on your door. Well, it began with an angry call from a radiologist upset over sloppy practices at a New York City hospital. Neonates were repeatedly given whole body x-rays with no protection, sometimes as many as 10 of them. And these practices had continued for a long time. Now that was the key for me, a long time. To me, that meant these problems were systemic within the hospital. No internal or external controls. And if problems like this were surfacing at this hospital, what's to say that they aren't happening at other hospitals around the country? And so began my 2-year reporting project on medical radiation.
Did you catch that, what I'm talking about? Here, I'm going to do what Walt does in this context to illustrate why I've had to record this section multiple times. A couple of years ago, I walked into a new patient consult with a middle-aged woman. She was in her 50s. She was in the room by herself, and she had been diagnosed with an oral tongue squamous cell carcinoma. When I was going through her records before that appointment, I saw that her diagnosis had actually been made well over a year ago. It was like 1 to 2 years before, at a pretty early stage, like stage 1. I couldn't find any records of her undergoing any treatment. And eventually I discovered it's because she didn't, and she was distrustful of doctors and just American medicine. Instead of doing what had been recommended to her early on, which was surgery, as was appropriate, she elected to do her own research and was using alternative therapies that she had found on the internet. And of course, that didn't work. And her disease continued to progress. And so when she finally realized that she needed conventional treatment, she went back to the ENT surgeons who had seen her in the beginning. And unfortunately, they correctly determined that the disease was now so extensive that surgery was virtually guaranteed to not be successful in terms of negative margins, but also in the morbidity of it for how much would need to be resected for this to be a success. So they told her she needed chemo and radiation. So she was very slow to agree to make an appointment with me. So this was a person who had already went out on her own and tried to use alternative therapies and then knew that was not working, knew that was a mistake. And so even after trying to go back and get conventional treatment, when she was told that she couldn't have surgery, she would need chemo and radiation, she continued to delay. And by the time I saw her, she could barely talk. She couldn't talk. She could make sounds, but we would mostly communicate via writing. And to this day, it's the most advanced case of oral tongue cancer I've ever seen. Hopefully I will ever see. Even though by the time I saw her, she had agreed to chemotherapy, she was still very reluctant to agree to radiation. And I couldn't figure it out. I could not figure out why, after just putting together this whole story, why she was still resistant to radiation. And in this, this was a couple of years ago, so I think this actually had to happen over more than one appointment, but I eventually, trying to figure out why she was okay with chemo, why she had changed her mind on surgery, but she is still refusing radiation or didn't want to consider it. And she pulled out her phone one day and showed me one of Walt's articles in the New York Times. And now that I knew that and we were able to talk about that, I was able to get her to agree to treatment. But obviously by this point, it was too late when she first came back to ask for surgery, but she got through chemo and radiation and there was actually disease response. But as is typical, she had lost her ability to taste. And that was basically before treatment really began. It had altered, but it was more before treatment had began. She had difficulty swallowing. She had lost like 70 pounds. It was a lot. And she wasn't interested in a PEG tube, which was obviously talked to her beforehand. She did have an NG tube, but after she got through radiation, this was over the course of a couple of weeks to a couple of months, I found out she was admitted to the hospital with the admitting diagnosis was aspiration pneumonia. And so by that point, she'd been dealing with this disease for 2 to 3 years. And at that point, she had felt that life wasn't worth living if she couldn't eat normally. And I had talked to her at length about this. Everyone had talked to her about this, that with her burden of disease at the time of treatment and then the treatment itself, her body needed time to heal. And that none of us knew, because none of us had seen this before, none of us knew what her new baseline would be in terms of taste and swallowing and function and all that, but it would take at least a year. And it had only been a few weeks, a few months. To her at that point, it didn't matter. And she decided she was going to decline all further interventions and she stopped eating and she died very quickly. I believe it was probably maybe 6 weeks after that had happened. And now, obviously, this case had a lot of factors that caused this outcome. And can I say for certain that if Walt didn't write these articles, she would still be alive? And no, of course, I can't say that. Can I say for certain that Walt's articles killed this woman? No, I can't say that. The one thing I can say is that Walt's articles contributed to her death. And those articles are over 10 years old. And this is not the first time. This one stands out because she actually had the articles to pull up and the fact that she died. But I have heard references to the newspaper articles over the years. And I'm sure everyone who has been in this specialty has had patients bring this up. And those are just the patients that are willing to come see me, just me, and then admit to that. And that's after a significant amount of discussion and trust building and whatnot. So how many people out there haven't even agreed to the consult with me or anyone else? And really then, how many lives have been lost because of Walt's articles in the New York Times? Now, for the physicians who listen to this podcast, you might feel angry at me for telling the story in this way or not. I genuinely don't know. But what I do know is that when you tell a story like this, and this story is true, like it's still a true story. These are my true opinions. This is all true. But the average person, and even we find these stories compelling, it's hardwired in us. And if you listen to what Walt and what basically every reporter ever has done, it's this. It's you tell a single anecdotal story, a tragic story, when it grabbed your attention, and then you make a very reasonable, logical leap, usually invoking time or scope, just like I did in my story. And it was a woman who came in and she pointed out his articles as to why she didn't do radiation or one of the reasons she died. I have had other patients tell me about this. It is reasonable, at least it's logical to make the leap. That is a thing that happens weekly, daily, yearly. It's happened a lot. Can I prove that? No, of course. But it's logical. And that's how in the UCSF clip, that's how this all got started for Walt, is that a single radiologist in one hospital, in one city, called and told him a story about something bad that was happening. And it was obviously bad, and he ran with it. And it's how he always does. That's how every other journalist does it, too. That's how this whole thing works. And it's the one thing we're trained not to do. Doing this is anathema in medicine. It's anecdote. And it's the exact same as if you did something weird one time with one patient and then you changed your entire practice around that disease because of it. We should hopefully never do that. That's the anti-evidence-based medicine, right? And that makes us insanely bad at defending ourselves. And Walt himself has noted this in the past. So if you go in, he's been doing this hospital medicine safety thing since I think the 80s. He wrote a book that was, I'd have to look back, but his first book was about hospital safety, I believe. And then he was asked to write a foreword in a different safety book that has nothing to do with any of the stuff we're talking about right now. And I'm not going to name names and give additional advertising, but in this book, the author of the other book describes asking Walt what the reaction is from doctors when they're presented with these atrocious safety stories. And Walt, the reading, it comes across as he's angry about it. He proclaims that the response is always to brush it off as anecdote. And sure, I totally believe that's what has happened to him when he finds these things and then approaches doctors either in the story or for comment. And we always say, anecdote. And that sets up this inherently ineffective defense. Because to a lay person, there's a reason you have to be trained in the scientific method. It is not natural. It is not how our day-to-day life works. The saying correlation does not equal causation, that's a thing you have to repeat a lot for a reason. Anecdotes are very powerful, and they're powerful to us too. And that it's so powerful that a significant amount of effort is spent throughout our training to just beat this out of us, to teach us the scientific method, to teach us to look for repeatable data. And so when someone comes to us with a sad, horrific story about something in medicine, we're not moved by it, or we're not moved enough. And because we are immediately digging into our brains, the training that we've had forever, and we're saying it's anecdote. We can't know if we can truly extrapolate from that. But to the layperson, to the person who's not in medicine, who's not trained in the scientific method, we are seen as cold and uncaring and as playing God, really. And on our side, we look at this person, these lay people, as foolish and irrational, extrapolating a single story to a systemic issue. The truth is somewhere in the middle. And I think we would do better to recognize that we can't respond, we can't invoke the scientific method as a response to this. We can't start talking about anecdotes. It's never going to work, and it's going to continue to harm us. And for really, if there's a whole, there's a reason there's the whole, I think even a lot of the journals have like storytelling in oncology or whatnot. This is evolutionary, hardwired into us. A really interesting book you guys should go read is by a guy named Robert Cialdini. I think he's technically in the Department of Sociology out at one of the, it's either New Mexico or Arizona, but he wrote a book called Persuasion. Or maybe it's Persuasion, but this is an entire area of research as to why our brains are susceptible to this. It's a thing. So we can't just brush it off because it's not going to, clearly has not worked so far. And Walt, it's hard for me to think about the true butterfly effect about Walt and about the New York Times and about other things, because his stories are shocking to a degree to me. So reading his stories or reading some of these whistleblower cases, it's wow, I can't believe that was a thing that was happening. Or listening to the podcast Dr. Death, both season one and especially season two, I don't know if there's a new one, but it is insane. Reflecting on how I practice medicine, how I think about medicine, the reasons I got into medicine, I can't believe that there are people out there doing some of these things. It's genuinely shocking to me. And there has to be a way to regulate that to a degree, of course, because now you would imagine our built-in training and screening and whatnot would weed out the psychos, but clearly not. Like money, when money's involved, everything goes out the window. But there's a world where I like things like Royals. I am deep, and I really deeply believe in safety and QI and all these things. And that's how in my real life, in my day-to-day job, this is something that I focus on quite a bit. As a community physician in a rural area, it's just by myself, I have very strong feelings about, essentially very influenced by like a Tawani's checklist manifesto and the research from before that. And I like to do things in a very repeatable, very predictable, very vanilla sort of way. I feel like that is the safest way to do things, to not get cute, to the staff should always know what I'm going to do as best as they can and have things very regimented. And I feel like that's the safest way. It's like flying an airplane. There's a reason there's checklists. And so I think this is incredibly important. And now some of the stories from Walt and other work, it's crazy that was allowed to happen. And then the problem is talking about these things is you get into all these legal stuff. It's I know what exists out there, even with these guardrails in place, and there's no perfect system. But in terms of the safety of radiation, in terms of radiation phobia, and if the Pulitzer nomination, if truly there's thousands of people out there being injured by radiation, I don't agree with that. And as has been pointed out, safety is no accident things. It's hard to get data on this. You can go looking for it, but what is there data? So to get away from anecdote, what does the data tell us about safety and radiation? And there's a 1998 paper from Cleveland Clinic published in JCO. It was basically looking at 1,925 consecutive patients treated with a total of 93,332 individual radiotherapy fields. Of that, 59 separate errors that affected 168 individual treatment fields were detected, which yielded a crude radiation delivery error rate of 0.18%. And that was back in the 90s. Then if you look at things that like malpractice claims, so there's two papers by a group at UCSD looking at this. So in 2017, in the Red Journal, they published a study looking at malpractice claims against radiation oncology from 2003 to 2012. And in that entire time, and this is nationally, so in that entire time, there were 362 closed claims involving radiation oncology. Only 102 or 28% were paid. And the same group before that in 2015 had published an even bigger paper on the topic. And that was from 1985 to 2012, collecting nationwide medical liability insurance information from a trade association. So in that entire time, there was 1,517 closed claims involving radiation oncology, of which 342 or 22.5% were paid. That's insane. That is an incredibly good safety record. Now, you could make the argument that we're missing things. Nothing is perfect, of course, but it has seemed to me, and both through my own experience, through my own practice, through my own training, through what I know is out there, radiation medicine is one of the safest practices out there, period. And there's a lot of guardrails in place, and we should be very proud of that. And the fact that the public does not know about that is shocking and sad, and we can do better. And I think like the conversation that's happening now, I think this is a known thing. We're moving in the right direction. But to bring this all back to supervision for episode two here, when we fight about supervision, we are putting on display for the public, like supervision is something that should be logical, or at least it's viewed as logical, when in reality, the nuance is much greater. And if we are lobbying and arguing that something like IGRT needs direct or even personal supervision, or however you want to define it, you are setting up an inherent fear of what we do. Because to me, and hopefully to everyone here, we know that every single fraction is personally supervised by at least usually two radiation therapists. So we have radiation therapists who are trained, certified professionals. This is their whole thing. And robots are not delivering radiation. People are. And so you have these professionals who, this is what they do. This is what they're for. Every single treatment, they're the ones who take the IGRT. It is personal supervision under the direction of radiation medicine physician. That is incredibly safe. We should be incredibly proud of that. So when we argue about the physician part of supervision, we are ignoring the fact that we have trained, certified radiation therapists who are personally supervising every single fraction is far safer than a lot of other things. And we're going to fight about things like virtual direct or virtual OTVs or those things. And then going to the virtual OTV thing, the on-treatment visit, do you not have nurses? Do you not have licensed RNs? And like my story from the prior episode about the internet kid with the spurious prostate patient with 103 temp, and that patient was being personally attended to. And I have never done a virtual OTV. I don't see really why I would, but I want the option. And when we have these arguments, we are maligning our colleagues in our multidisciplinary field. And people should be operating at the top of their license. And if you are telling the public that a physician needs to babysit a LINAC, then that is communicating a certain unsafe nature of what we're doing. And that is not the case at all. Now, if you are arguing that because you're worried about the job market, that's a whole other thing. And obviously, I'm very worried about the job market, but I would never hang my hat on LINAC babysitting as the thing that's going to keep us afloat. If that's what's going on here, we really need to reevaluate what's going on. But the point being, this is why people care about this. So this is episode one was about definitions. This is the consequences, or why, if you're in your early career and you're confused as to why certain people are so fired up about this, this is the history. And this was, again, a very concentrated piece of time. And so the next episode will be about how in 2020, we switched over to general supervision for hospital outpatients, and with the pandemic, the virtual direct supervision, and then about a case that was brought initially in 2016, a whistleblower case, but then was settled. I don't know if you can really say it's been settled, but in 2020 through 2022, there had been multiple filings and briefs and opinions by the court saying, basically, again, as I had said earlier, it's Todd's case, but in current day, and the government does not agree with what the government did in 2008 or whatever. But anyway, on that note, can you see why I chop these episodes up? But till next time, friends.
This has been a Photon Media production. Don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen to us. Be well and be mom.